Samuel Dias had returned to New York to stand at Abraham's gravesite, where he said the Kaddish to honor his father's passing from the world. He had been gone to Jamaica and Brazil, and to islands that had no name, and seas where there was no wind. He'd spied dozens of trees he might have brought back, beautiful, unusual specimens that had never been seen in New York. Pink trumpet trees, blue jacarandas, rosewood trees with green and white flowers, but this time his only cargo had been barrels of dark rum. Samuel left the trees where they were, though each one had made him think of Maria Owens. All the same, a gift given to someone who wants nothing from you is worthless. He knew that now, though he still dreamed of the expression on Maria's face when she looked out the window of the jail and declared the magnolia to be a miracle. Samuel was growing tired of the sea and its loneliness, something he had always been grateful for as a younger man. At night, he stood on the deck and watched the creatures beneath the water and thought of the first ship he'd ever sailed upon, when the navigator his father had enlisted took him under his wing and taught him to read the stars. Back then, he could still remember everything about his mother and sisters. Now it was difficult for him to bring up their faces, although there were certain things that he would never forget. His sisters singing as they walked up a hill, his mother telling him his first stories, the bonfire on her burning day, the white hood covered with stars that she was made to wear, how empty the world was without her. He had felt the same sort of aloneness once again when Maria told him to leave. The sharpness of her dismissal was still as fresh as it had been the day he left Manhattan. He was deeply hurt, and it was this emotion that had made him stay away. But it also caused him to walk past the house on Maiden Lane, even though he had no intention of stopping. Samuel had too much pride to go where he wasn't wanted, and yet he was drawn there like a dog. He waited to see if there was a glimmer of life, perhaps a lantern when dusk fell, or smoke from the brick oven's chimney. When he saw none of these things, he went closer, pulled forward despite his will. Spring in New York meant horseshit in the streets, and sewers running into the footpaths, and crowds of newcomers. The city was so alive. Samuel Dias felt his aloneness all the more here than he did at sea. He went through the gate in the falling dusk, for he was a fool. He admitted that to himself, and his hurt drove him on. The garden was filled with weeds, and the tree of heaven was in need of water. He went to the well and filled a pail, then watered the tree. But he could already tell it would do no good. This genus belonged in the tropics and was never meant to be here. He went to try the door and found it locked. He had a sinking feeling in the pit of his stomach. All the while he'd been gone, he imagined Maria in this house, but now it appeared he'd been wrong, for the place was clearly abandoned, though he owned it still.
"You're to be off the property."
It was a man's voice he heard, English by the sound of it. Dias turned to see a fellow with a horsewhip in his hand, then glanced around and spied a spade he could use if he needed a weapon.
"Am I?"
"Sorry, brother, but this is private property."
"I know, it's mine."
The other fellow laughed out loud. A Cornishman, that's what he was. Samuel had known many who'd taken to sea, though they all seemed to long for their homeland, and when they'd had enough to drink, they cried, desperate to return to a place they couldn't wait to leave behind when they were young.
"Since I'm well acquainted with the owner," the fellow told Samuel, "I can tell you that you're wrong."
Samuel fished around in his bag and brought out his key to the door.
"If it fits the lock, I may have to believe you," the Cornishman, who said he was called Finney, now allowed.
When the key fitted perfectly, there was no fight to be had, and although they were still cautious, the men shook hands. They sat down in the garden chairs, where Abraham Dias used to spend hours when he realized he loved being on land and became an avid gardener. Finney was made to understand that this man, who was wearing a black coat in the fine weather, as he did every day of his life,
for he'd never shaken the chill brought on by his disease, was indeed the owner of the house. I could tell you many things about why and how Maria came to be here. I could talk all day, but I'd rather you do the talking, he suggested to Finney. He was told that Faith had disappeared, and Maria had recently set off after her, traveling first to Boston, then to Salem. It was clear this fellow Finney knew the girl well, and that Maria had placed her trust in him. She had gone to see him in the Bowery the day she left. Because he'd saved her life, Faith would forever owe him her loyalty, a situation Samuel understood, for his life had been saved as well, and his loyalty was unwavering. The way I see it, the girl owes me nothing, Finney said. Yet she had appeared with a gift before leaving for Salem, for they might never see each other again, and she offered him an elixir she called Live Well Tea. She advised that he drink it every morning. He had done so, for he trusted Faith Owens, and his life had indeed improved. His new wife, Catherine, could not have children, but a little girl had been abandoned in the fly market with a note pinned to her dress. She is yours. Finney and Catherine had adopted her and now called the child their own. It was his heart's desire to be a father again, one he'd never spoken of, and yet Faith had seen through him. She had given him what he wanted most in the world. I worry for her, Finney admitted. The art she's working is dark, and it takes a toll. Maria's gone to save the girl from herself. Finney's eyes brightened. Maybe you should go after her. No, Diaz laughed. I couldn't. I've been told to stay away. You don't seem a man who will do as he's told. When Samuel shook his head, Finney went on. I'm asking you to go after them, and that cancels out what she told you. I'm asking on Faith's behalf. She thinks I'm the one who saved her, but she's got it all wrong. I was a dead man when I found her in the Flatlands. My life was over and done with. She's the one who saved me. Samuel thought this over after Finney had left. He was a man who enjoyed a good argument, but he was humble as well, and could admit when he'd made a mistake. He thought perhaps the Cornishman had been right. Samuel had saved Maria's life on her hanging day, so perhaps he was not the only one with a debt to pay. Perhaps they owed their loyalty to one another. He sat in the garden until dark, when a chill sifted into the soft spring air. Then he went inside, still trying to make his decision. It had been a long time since he'd been home, and though the house was empty and dim, it was still so familiar it was as if he'd been here only days before. There was a lantern on the table, and he took out the small brass tinderbox that he carried to strike a light. He sat hunched in his black coat. He could have started a fire in the fireplace or gone upstairs to sleep. But he spied a letter on the table, his name on the envelope that had been sealed with red wax. Samuel knew the script, those perfect black letters. Perhaps the sight had allowed her to see that he would come back. He took his knife and slit open the envelope. We do things when we're young that we regret. I believed that love was my enemy, but I was wrong. He folded the letter into his coat and made certain to lock the door when he left. It took less than 2 hours to get together a crew willing to sail to Salem, for there was no cargo, and the lighter the ship, the faster the journey. He was in a hurry. That much was true. He recalled the woman who had given him directions to the jail and went to her house straight away. Anne Hatch spied him through the window and opened the door, beckoning him to come up the stairs. I remember you, the man with the tree. As she had years ago, when he first arrived in Salem, she fetched him a plate of chicken stew. He thanked her and ate, ravenous, and when he was finished, he told her he had come for Maria once again. If she ever did come back here, I figure she'd go out to that house she had, Anne said. He took the path in the woods, headed to the spot where he had planted the tree.
It was dark when he arrived, and the air was damp and cool. Exhausted, he lay down in the grass, using his satchel as a pillow and his coat as a blanket, falling asleep so quickly he didn't hear the clacking sound in the ground beside him. A wretched noise he would have recognized as the one he'd heard outside the jail on Maria's hanging day. The sound of a beetle no one in this world wishes to hear. Hathorn was enraged when he returned home, for the final meeting of the magistrates had been filled with petty jealousies and hostilities, with judges blaming each other, now that Governor Phipps had dispatched a decree that the witchcraft trials must stop and those in custody be allowed their freedom. A clerk whose aunt was currently in jail left the courthouse and was quick to spread the news throughout the town. Soon there were families all over Essex County who were celebrating. They praised the governor's wisdom. They lit bonfires in the fields and brought wreaths of wildflowers to the hidden graves of those who had already been hanged, their bodies stolen by their families, so that they might be secretly buried, for those deemed witches were not allowed even that last bit of dignity. Faith was washing up after dinner. The family had dined, but Faith had made the cursed stew meant for John Hathorn alone, and had baked a crust for revenge pie, fixed from the bramble, what some people call blackberry, used in transference magic. Into the pie, she baked the bird she had killed. After a few bites, his luck would turn. His roof would blow off in every storm. His son would set off to sea. He would not have a night of sleep. He sat at the table when he called for her. She brought out a tray with the stew and a plate of pie and a pot of tell-the-truth tea. Everyone else in the house was asleep. The peepers were trilling with their shivery song, for it was the time of year when everything comes alive, birds and bees and frogs. Faith had the Book of the Raven tucked inside her dress, burning her chest. She had a talisman in hand, made after finding a blackthorn bush in the woods, a wild, bitter plum whose shimmering black bark was covered by large black spines. She'd collected a handful of spines, even though her fingers bled, and she pressed them into a ball of wax and hatred, a charm to carry with her, which would increase her power and cause this man who was her father pain throughout his body, something unnameable and incurable. If she attached it to him, the revenge would be threefold, strong enough to burn a hole right through him. What she wished for was that forever after, throughout history, Hathorn would be remembered as a man who had no conscience, as he had called for the murder of 20 innocent people. The colony itself seemed cursed. Crops failed, smallpox spread, and many wondered if God saw fit to punish them for acts against blameless people. A day of humiliation would be declared, a day of prayer and fasting, in the hopes that God would forgive them. But Hathorn would never ask for forgiveness. He would never ask for any sort of pardon from men or from God. "At last," he said, when Faith set down his supper tray, so annoyed he might have been waiting for hours rather than minutes. Faith watched as he ate the stew. Afterward, he downed a large tumbler of water. He was parched from the start of the enchantment. Faith felt quite thirsty herself. Perhaps being in his presence affected her more than she would have imagined. "I have no need of an audience," Hathorn said, when he realized her eyes were on him. "I'm ready for my tea." He, like so many men in Salem, most often took his meals alone, away from the distractions of his family. Faith cut him a piece of pie. Hathorn didn't usually like sweets, but after one bite, he couldn't stop eating the blackthorn revenge pie. "Ruth was correct about one thing," Hathorn allowed. "You know how to bake."
"I know more than that. I know you. But you, do you not know me?" Faith asked when he was through.
"I know when a girl is rude and improper, if that's what you're trying for."
He felt defeated, for the governor's edict and letter
had made those who had judged the witch trials seem like fools, and worse, like criminals themselves. It was said that a Dutch doctor had influenced the governor to end the trials. John thought perhaps he would fight it. He had time before all of those now incarcerated could be processed and released, if they ever were. Lydia Coulson, Elizabeth Coulson's grandmother, had already died in jail due to the harsh conditions and her frail health. Hathorne would have chased the housemaid away after his supper, but he had a sudden urge to tell someone the truth about his life. Now that the governor had stopped the trials, he feared how the world would judge him. They would laugh at all he had tried to do in an attempt to rid the world of evil. Tonight he himself wavered in his beliefs. Perhaps all along the beast had been inside of him.
"I thought you might tell me something about love," Faith said.
He laughed at her sheer nerve. Ruth really had no business taking in strangers. Hathorne stood up, for he knew the intimidating effect of his height on most people, although right away he could see this girl wasn't the least bit cowed. "I'll have you let go in the morning. You should pack tonight."
"So you know nothing about love?"
He gave her a dark look. Girls her age were foolish, dreamy things. "You marry as you're expected to." He was blathering on for no reason, telling her the truth of his feelings. Well, what did it matter? She'd soon enough be gone. "So yes, I know nothing about love. Perhaps I'm incapable of it."
"Wasn't there a woman some time ago? You must have loved her."
"In Curacao," he said, before he could stop himself. "I left without saying a word. I didn't know what to do with her. She wanted too much, and all I wished for was to be left in peace. It all went wrong before I thought it through."
He had no idea why he'd said all that. It made him sound as if he were a coward, and then, quite suddenly, he realized that he was. His eyes and throat burned. As a child, he was caned if he wept, but now he feared that if he weren't careful, he'd soon be crying in front of this housemaid. Love was nothing he thought about. It hadn't affected him in the least, except for a day or two when he was enchanted, when he seemed to be another man entirely. Hathorne thought of his wife on their wedding night, weeping for her parents. He didn't say a word to comfort her. He just did as he pleased. He imagined the women on trial begging for their lives, the ones in prison, the ones who'd been hanged. Hathorne had seen evil everywhere, but now it resided within him. That was the truth, if he was to tell it. That was what he was saying now. "I would change things if I could. I would be another man." He shook his head and pushed the tea away. "I was that for a while." "Men don't change who they are deep inside. You must have hid yourself from her."
Hathorne narrowed his eyes.
It had been a hellish day, and that hell continued now. "Who do you think you are?"
"Who do you think I am?" the girl replied. And then he knew. He looked closely and saw what was directly before him. She was indeed his daughter. Too smart for her own good. He was impressed, despite himself. The cool, gray gaze, the fearlessness, the way she could hold her own against him. He wished his son could do as well. It was then that the black charm fell from the folds of Faith's garment and rolled upon the floor. Hathorne knew it for what it was, some sort of wicked curse. He should have expected as much. She was not only his daughter, but also the daughter of a witch. Evil is drawn to evil. Truth is drawn to truth. Before he could reach for it, Faith picked up the charm, though it pierced her hands. "I've decided not to use it," Faith said. It was true. She'd done enough damage, and had already changed his fate. She had seen her likeness in his eyes. A wounded person who wounded others. "I had it with me in case you acted against me with ill will, for my own protection," I think we shan't wait till morning, he said. You can leave tonight.
I will do so. Faith untied her apron, then pulled off her cap. Her red hair shone in the dim light of the room.
You've been making me say all I've said tonight. You'll leave here now and not come back. If you were anyone else, I would have you arrested.
But the witch trials were over, and if anything, he might face charges for having a child outside of his marriage. Best to be rid of her, as he'd rid himself of Maria. He took out a purse of coins, which she quickly refused. He shook his head. She was nothing but trouble.
You're very like your mother, he said.
Thank you. Faith's eyes were burning. I was afraid I might take after you. She threw out the rest of the pie, so no one else in the household would mistakenly eat it. Inside were the bird bones, fragile little things that made a sob rise in Faith's throat. This is where left-handed magic had brought her, to the black edges of revenge. As it was, the cursed stew would change John Hathorne's future and his standing in history. Faith left a note for Ruth, thanking her for her kindness. She wondered if Ruth had known who she was, and had taken her in to make up for how John Hathorne had wronged her. It didn't matter anymore. Faith no longer wanted anything, not even revenge. It had changed her into something she didn't wish to be, and the price was too high. She made sure to lock the door when she left. She had met her father, and he had met her, and she didn't know which of them was the worse for having done so. Two farmers spied her in the field, in her black cape and red boots, running as fast as she could. They knew immediately what she was. She was followed by a dark, shifting shape, a wolf with silver eyes. When she left the Hathorns, she'd found that Keeper was waiting in the garden. No matter what she had done, he still belonged to her, and she to him. She went on her knees to embrace him before they ran off together, stumbling into this wretched place where men found evil in everything they saw, in shoes, in cloaks, in wolves, in women. The farmers would later tell the constable that she had set their barn on fire, but in fact they themselves overturned a lantern in their hurry to chase after her, guns in hand. When there is murder intended, murder will be the result. They shot into the dark as if the dark itself were their enemy. They had both been there on the day the crows died, and it was an event that still thrilled them, for they had embroidered the story with an attack of murderous crows sent by the devil himself. When they heard a howl, they thought it was a she-wolf. But it was Faith, crying out as Keeper fell into the grass. She sank to her knees and held her hands over the bloody wounds, reciting an incantation of protection, but it was impossible to staunch the flow of blood. She was reaching for the Book of the Raven, so distraught she didn't notice when men came up behind her, guns ready. The barn was in flames now, and the men blamed her, though she had only passed by. A witch's presence can cause mayhem, and now that they had her, they feared her. They wrapped chains around Faith and studied her as she cursed them, a girl drenched in wolf's blood, powerless at last, the sort of girl they'd like to drown. Dr. Joost Vandenberg was kind enough to hire a carriage to take Maria to Salem. Governor Phipps had changed the way an alleged witch could be tried. By October, the trials would be completely outlawed. Because of this success, the doctor had offered Maria an appointment to be his personal secretary, but she kindly turned him down. She did, however, accept his offer to find her a solicitor, and on her way out of Boston, the carriage stopped so that a fellow named Benjamin Hardy could draw up a trust and a will. She had come up with a plan to build a grand house in Salem, one that could never be sold and always remain in the family. This trust would ensure that the Owens women would always have a home. Maria had not been back to Essex County since the night she left for New York with Samuel. She had been so young the first time she'd seen these green fields and the marshy land abutting the North River, only 17. It was impossible to know then what she knew now. The carriage stopped on Washington Street. Maria had looked in the black mirror to see Faith standing on the path to the door, empty now and covered by fallen leaves. She thanked the driver and went up the path. Ruth heard a knock at the door, and she knew who had come. She felt a shiver inside of her, the same feeling she'd had when she was a girl and the sheriff had told her that her parents were gone. When Ruth opened the door, they recognized each other, as if it had been only days since Maria had been driven along the road in an ox cart, wearing a white sackcloth, her hair shorn. The truth of it was that Ruth had imagined running after her, but she had stayed here, behind the gate. "All I want is my daughter," Maria told her. Ruth understood a mother's love and concern. "I knew she was his daughter. She resembles him, but she's not here now. He sent her away." Hathorne had punished Ruth for taking on the girl without his permission. Look where it had led. He was still coughing up small bits of bird bone. Ruth had been made to get on her knees and recite passages of scripture for hours without a drink of water or a bit of rest. Maria could hear the thudding of Ruth's heart. She did not envy her life. "Tell me where she's gone." "If I knew, I would. I promise you that." Did he know her for who she was? During Ruth's punishment, the tea Hathorne had been given was still at work, and he told her the truth. The girl was his flesh and blood. "He did. I could tell he thought she was clever," Ruth said. He hadn't said as much, but she knew from the way he looked at the girl, each time she hadn't backed down. "Now I see she's very much like you." "Did she hurt him?" Maria asked. "Oh, no," Ruth said. "If anything, I suppose she was hurt by him." Relieved, Maria threw her arms around the other woman. Then just as quickly, she broke off the embrace and hurried through the garden gate. The black leaves unfurled and fell like rain. Standing in the doorway, Ruth put a hand over her eyes. Maria was already gone, as if she had flown, as people once said she did, when they swore she rose like a crow above the fields at night. Pine, oak, chestnut, plum tree, elm, walnut, ash, witch hazel, wild cherry. Maria could find her way without thinking, running as fast as she could. It might be possible that Faith had escaped the darkest reaches of left-handed magic. Either way, she was desperate to get her girl back. She went through the fields and didn't think about Caden and the night when the men of Salem set out to kill as many birds as they could. She didn't think about the winter when 8 feet of snow fell, the coldest winter, when bread rattled on the plate. She didn't think about her loneliness, a well so deep she couldn't bear it. She didn't think of the man waiting in the trees when the rope broke, waiting for her all this time, waiting for her still. Perhaps she flew as crows do, for in no time she had made her way to the shed that had been their home, the roof covered with grapevines, and the tumbled-down fence meant to keep rabbits and deer out of the garden. She looked at none of it, for on this day every flower on the magnolia had opened, so that the sky appeared to be filled with stars, and beneath the tree was the man she loved. They were older than they had been, but they saw each other as they once were. A 16-year-old girl with diamonds in the palm of her hand, a man of 23 who kept the note she'd left for him in his coat. That was who they were beneath the tree. They had no time, so they didn't think, and for once Samuel didn't talk. They belonged to each other, and they didn't stop, not even to take off their boots. They could hold what they had in their hands. They could see it with their own eyes, and they weren't about to give it up now. They went to town to search the taverns. They looked in the windows of the house on Washington Street and in Martha Chase's abandoned house where the roof had fallen in. They hunted through the woods, peering into shadowy caves where bears slept, investigating the stony ridgetops where there were still wolves, despite all that had been done to destroy them. Faith was not to be found. After midnight, they were back beneath the magnolia tree. They climbed into the tallest branches so they might look for sparks in the sky or bonfires lit in the fields, any signs of life. Maria fell asleep for a brief time, there in the branches, nesting like a crow. She dreamed of dark water, and when she woke, she was drenched, even though there had been no rain. Samuel was sleeping still, holding on to a bough of the tree. Long ago, before they'd ever met, before either of them had come to the second Essex County, they had each made the same promise. They would never watch another woman burn. But there were other ways to be rid of a woman who didn't behave, who did as she pleased, who had courage, who talked back. You held her head under water until she could no longer speak. The farmers locked Faith in a neighbor's barn, for their own barn was smoldering ash. They would have brought her to the magistrate, but the governor had outlawed the witch trials, so they tried her themselves and found her guilty. They had been the judges, and they would be the executioners. It was the Lord's Day when they dragged her to the lake in chains. It was early morning, with a mist rising and the sky breaking into bands of color. The men had frightened themselves with their own cruelty and their own imaginings. They had convinced themselves they had caught a servant of the devil and not a 13-year-old girl who pleaded for her life until she realized it wasn't any use to beg. Now she was speaking backwards, an incantation from the Book of the Raven hidden in her cloak. That beautiful book a woman had written to help other women save themselves. Women who were bought and sold, women who had no voice, women forced to have secret lives, women who knew that words were the most powerful magic. Faith had vowed to leave the left side and forsake black magic, but she turned to it now. She was wrapped in irons, therefore the spell couldn't do much damage. Still, the men's throats began to close up, and when they tried to speak to each other, they could only grunt as if they were animals. Their hands appeared to be changing, as if they had claws rather than nails. It was the spell of the beast, when an individual shows what resides within him, and it is only dark magic if there is darkness within. The farmers were brothers, Harold and Isaac Hopwood, cruel men who were even more brutal after drink, and they had been drinking all night. Their barn had burned down, and they needed someone to blame. Blame a woman, drown a woman, let the Lord be the judge. They carried her to the lake, which was as deep as the end of the world, the waters where her own mother had been tested as a witch, a lake that no man, woman, or child would enter, for it was said to be cursed, and certainly there were leeches in the shallow, reedy water, and the lilies were attached to black weeds that reached all the way to hell. The brothers carried a chair that Faith had been bound to with rope. There were still irons around her arms, chains the farmers used to keep their cows in place. Ready to be rid of her, they could tell she was bad luck, and even though she was a girl, they feared her. They sent her out as if on a boat, so that she drifted out from the shore. Courts and magistrates meant nothing to the brothers. They would make their own law on their own land. The Hopwoods were sweating through their clothes, but they were chilled as well, and they still felt the tightness in their throats. What was done, and surely they were in the Lord's favor, and yet there was fear seeping into their bones, as if they were as brittle as twigs, as if they might break and turn into a heap of dust. Faith's black cloak rose up, a dark flower that was disappearing as it sank below the surface. Her face was white, a lily. She remembered when she had a vision in Maud Carty's parlor in Brooklyn, when she was underwater and about to enter hell, and she knew this is what she had foreseen, the dark water rushing in, and her own tears, a witch's tears, tears that burned as if they were made of fire.
When Maria climbed down and stood in the grass, she saw a dozen crows winging across the sky. The day was bright, and she could spy the blue center of the lake in the distance. She took off running without a word. Samuel Diaz called to her, but she wouldn't stop, and so he followed through the woods, not knowing where he was going, disoriented as he made his way through the brambles. Maria was in front of him, and when he looked through the trees, she seemed to be flying, untouched, whereas he had to dodge tree stumps and branches, cursing as he ran. Maria spied the men at the shore. She knew right away they were the ones who had her daughter. Metal, ropes, fire, water. She saw a long red hair on one of the Hopwood brothers' coats. She spied the aura of disaster, a dark, ashy shade. Maria was almost upon them when she stumbled upon a book that had been dropped on the rough path. Once held in her hands, the Book of the Raven fell open to a spell of protection, meant to stop an attack and hold the assailants at bay. She began the incantation right then, and as she spoke, the branches swayed and leaves fell down and turned the water green. She could not stop speaking it. She must continue until they were driven off. There was the scent of fire, and the brothers felt as if their skin was burning. Still, they waded into the water, pushing the chair out farther. It was then Maria heard the Death Watch beetle. Her breath was sharp and cold. The clacking sound was louder. It echoed now. She continued the incantation. She would not lose faith a third time. She recited the spell faster until her lips were burning, until the brother's skin was aflame. They turned to see her, and later they would swear she was levitating, standing in the air rather than on the ground. They were cursed, and they knew it. There were leeches in their boots, and they had forgotten their own names. They let go of the chair, unable to do any more harm to Faith, watching the witch on the shore as she hexed them. The chair was sinking into the center of the lake that was so green it seemed made of grass. Faith's red hair was still above the water, the color of blood and of hearts torn asunder. By now Samuel had reached the lake. He had already stripped off his black coat as he ran into the shallows, nearly stumbling as he pulled off his boots. The Hopwood brothers tried to stop him as he raced past. Perhaps they thought he was the devil himself, and it was their duty to attack him. But Maria still had the book of magic in her hands, and she made it impossible for them to cause any more damage. They were stuck where they were, unable to move, hip deep in the water, yet convinced they had been set on fire. The water had turned from green to black, so murky it was impossible to see anything at all. For a moment, Maria stopped speaking. Faith and Samuel had both disappeared. In that moment of silence, when she stopped reading from the book, the brothers all but trampled one another as they ran to shore and through the woods, afraid for their lives, desperate to be as far away from Maria as possible, as if distance made any difference to a curse. Samuel resurfaced, then dove again. He was an expert swimmer, but the lake was muddy, and he had to feel his way. A dark creature swam beneath him, a huge eel he could barely see, but the eel pushed Faith upward so that Samuel could grab the girl by her cloak, hauling her out of the chains that bound her to the wooden chair, which now sank and went on sinking to the endless bottom of the lake. When Samuel tried to swim to the surface, he realized the water weeds had hold of him, wrapped around his ankles and legs. He was caught, but he pushed Faith upward and watched her rise to the surface through the bits of sunlight that pierced the cloudy water. Samuel knew that he was drowning. His leg was trapped, no matter how he tugged. He moved his arms, still trying to swim, not yet giving up, but it was happening whether he fought against it or not. He had seen other men drown. They had fallen from the riggings of ships or leapt into the currents while drunk, and he had wondered how it felt to be taken by the water, if it was a struggle, or if it was more like a dream. He hadn't had a breath for so long, his heart was stopping. He thought of Maria on the dock in Curaçao, and how he had fallen in love with her then, even though he was bent over with pain. Samuel now felt an even sharper pain across his chest from the pressure of the water. It began in his heart and seared through his arm, then his throat, and finally his head. He had a single thought, and it was she. And then he gave that up as well, though it burned inside him. The way he was dying felt like a dark bonfire in a lake that had no end. Faith was spitting water, alive, and so Maria didn't wait another instant. She quickly filled her boots with stones, then shoved them back on. She repeated the incantation for protection, calling to Hecate, offering her devotion if only she could be granted this one thing. One time underwater, that was all she wanted. Maria ran into the lake, past her shoulders, past her neck. She dove and went under, the stones in her boots weighing her down. She saw through the darkness, and there was Samuel Diaz, floating in the mucky water, already a dead man. She dragged him out of the tangle of water weeds that had held him down. The threaded roots were green and slimy and black, even though they opened into flowers on the surface. To float once more, Maria kicked off her boots, and as the stones fell into the bottomless darkness, she arose. She pulled Samuel toward the marshy shore, a sob escaping from her mouth as she shivered. Water streamed down her back and into her eyes. Maria had always been able to hear Samuel's heartbeat when he was near, and now she heard nothing at all. She tore open his shirt and pounded on his chest, her own breathing ragged. Faith crawled over, drenched and in despair. "Goat," she wailed, "wake up!" There was no answer, and Faith began to cry. She was on her knees beside her grieving mother, both coated with mud, weeds in the folds of their clothes, lake water dripping from their hair. Diaz's skin was pale, and he was so very quiet. It was clear that he was gone. "You have to stop," Faith told her mother. She knew death when she saw it. She'd seen it before. "Mother, he's no longer with us." His spirit had left him, and he was motionless. The beetle had stopped its clicking, for its work was done. Maria would not let this be their fate. She pounded on Samuel's chest again and again in a fury. They had wasted time because of a curse. Death was always possible with or without magic. Her own mother had confided that there was an ancient bargain a person could make with the darkest powers, one that would bring back the dead to walk among the living. "He will never be the same if you do. He will be a shadow self, a dark creature, but you will have him." Mothers had done this with children, only to have the rescued child run away into the woods, a feral creature with no memory of the past. Wives had brought back husbands who had afterward left them for other women, or stolen from them, or murdered them in their sleep. Maria didn't care. She was ready to make the bargain. She hit Samuel's chest one last time, ready to take up a knife so that she might cut her arm to mix her blood with his, the beginning of this dreaded spell. But before she could, Samuel opened his eyes. He had been dead until Maria forced his heart into beating. He'd returned from the dark water, from the darkness of the endless depth, where he had seen his father sitting in a garden chair, waving him away. "Don't be a fool," Abraham Diaz called to his son. "She's waiting for you, you stupid man." Maria lay beside him in the grass, her arms around him. You cannot curse a man who has already died and come back. He has rid himself of one life and begun another, a life in which love is everything. He had been dead, but now his eyes were open and the woman he loved was singing to him. "A ship there is, and she sails the sea. She's loaded deep, as deep can be, but not so deep as the love I'm in. I know not if I sink or swim."
The water is wide, I cannot get o'er it, and neither have I wings to fly. Give me a boat that will carry two, and both shall row, my love and I.
Samuel had to strain to hear Maria's voice, but soon he understood she was saying she wanted to be with him no matter the cost.
"Are we ruined?" Samuel asked. The world was so bright and beautiful. Like his father before him, he had a new appreciation of the earth.
"No," Maria said. She was as sure of this as she'd ever been of anything. "We're just alive." While Samuel slept in the grass, Faith and Maria sat together in the falling dark. They had made a bonfire, and sparks rose into the black sky. Faith gazed at her left palm. The line that had stopped when she found the Book of the Raven had begun again. She would live to be an old woman. She saw that now. But one who couldn't work magic. That was the price she paid when she ignored the rules. She'd lost the sight, and with it her bloodline gifts. She was ordinary now.
"If you don't want me to be your daughter, I would understand," Faith told her mother. "You'll always be my daughter."
Now and forever, in this life and the life to come, no matter what separated them or what brought them together. At the first light, Faith would return to the field and bring Keeper back to the bonfire so that her loyal companion would be turned to ashes here in the woods where he belonged. They watched the bonfire burn and remembered when they first saw fireflies and thought stars had dropped from the sky. When Keeper was a pup and drank goat's milk, when Caden brought gifts of buttons and keys, when they plucked apples from the trees, when the world of Essex County was brand new. Samuel Diaz was asleep in the grass, his black coat still soaking wet. He was still dreaming when Maria Owens leaned in to tell him a story, one he already knew and had known ever since he saw her on the dock in Curaçao, when she was fated to save his life. And he was fated to save hers in return.
Part 6. Fate. 1696. 12 carpenters had worked for a year without stopping to build Maria Owens' house. 15 varieties of wood were used: golden oak, silver ash, cherry wood, elm, pine, hemlock, pear, maple, mahogany, hickory, beech, cypress, cedar, walnut, and birch. The house was tall, with a twisted vine of wisteria that ran along the porch, in bloom at the first surge of spring. In the kitchen, there sat a huge black cast-iron stove. In the pantry were dozens of shelves on which to store herbs. 2 staircases had been constructed. One led to the attic, turning and twisting as if it were a puzzle bending in on itself. The other was made of the finest oak, with a broad landing that offered a window seat framed by damask drapes imported from England, ones very like those that had hung in the Lachlan's Manor House in the first Essex County. Beside the front door was the brass bell that had hung outside Hannah Owen's door. When a traveling portrait painter came through town, he was hired to capture Maria's likeness in oils, rendering her image perfectly, down to the bump she had on her hand, from the day she pounded on John Hathorne's door. When sitting for the painter, she wore her favorite blue dress, with her dark hair caught up in a blue ribbon, and the sapphire that she never took off fastened at her throat. She wore her new red boots, one Samuel Diaz had fashioned in Boston, which she wore every day. It was said that her eyes followed you when you passed by her portrait, and that she could see what was inside you, and that you would know in that moment whether or not you had been true to yourself. There were dozens of green glass windows imported from England,
and two brick chimneys that towered above the roof. The house was so well made that when a hurricane struck, every other house on the street sustained severe damage, but not a single shutter blew away from the Owens house. Even the laundry out on the line stayed exactly where it was on that day, which led neighbors to gossip even more than before. Maria kept chickens and goats in a small barn, and there was a renegade swan that arrived one day and refused to leave, soon enough spoiled by the crusts of bread he preferred to wild food. Maria called him Jack, and he waited outside for her on the porch every morning and followed her about all day long, accompanying her on city streets and into shops, so that the children in town whispered that he'd once been a man who'd been turned into a swan, though no one dared to come near him, for Jack had a nasty temper and was devoted to one person alone. In the garden there grew lily, rue, and arnica, along with fiery onions that could cure dog bites and toothaches. Maria planted Spanish garlic in great abundance, peonies to ward off evil, rows of lettuce, parsley, and mint, and lavender planted for luck by the back door. The original shed had been attached to a glass greenhouse so that herbs could be grown all year long, even in the dead of winter. Behind the foggy windows, there were pots filled with lemon balm, lemon verbena, and lemon thyme. The more dangerous plants were kept inside the locked shed, which now boasted a murky glass ceiling so that light could enter. Belladonna, yarrow, black nightshade, wolfsbane, foxglove, lords and ladies with its pretty toxic berries, pennyroyal, which could end a pregnancy. It was there that Maria kept her grimoire and its black toadskin cover, a book that would belong to Faith upon her mother's death, so that she might learn magic all over again from the start, but not until she was a very old woman who had come to understand the importance of the rules. On the first page, Hannah had written the rules of magic, and now Maria added a third, doing so without hesitation. Some lessons you have to learn for yourself. Others are best to know from the start. Do as you will, but harm no one. What you give will be returned to you threefold. Fall in love whenever you can. Perhaps the grimoire was the reason toads collected in the garden, or perhaps they merely enjoyed the varieties of greens Maria grew. Sorrel, dandelion, spinach, and chard. At the rear of the large yard, there was a small orchard of fruit trees, plum, peach, pear, and several varieties of apple, all having been set into the earth in the dark of the moon. Maria left the acreage between the house and the lake as free and open land, there for all to enjoy, a gift that would bring a blessing to her family. The fence that circled the house was of an unusual construction, black metal with spikes, laid out in the form of a snake with its tail in its mouth, ensuring that the only way someone could reach the door was to walk through the front gate where the ivy grew wild. Maria nailed the skull of a horse she had found in the Hopwoods pasture to a post to send a message to unwanted visitors. That pasture was deserted now that the brothers had disappeared in the middle of the night, headed west, still unable to speak, dreaming every night that they were drowning in a dark, bottomless lake, and waking each morning with mouths full of water. 20 blue stones from the old path to the shed had been used to fashion a pathway to the house. Every night women came for what they needed most, red pepper tea for an upset stomach, or butterfly weed for nerves, or a bar of black soap that could take years off their age, or a charm for love. Love was what Maria was best at, and she didn't fight it anymore. Let the rumors be spoken. Logical people knew that a woman in trouble would never be turned away from Maria Owen's door. If she went anywhere in the middle of the night, wrapped in a dark cloak and carrying her bag of curatives and teas, it was to visit an ill child. All the same, there was always bound to be talk about a household of women. Not that it stopped people from coming to the door late at night in search of assistance, particularly in matters of love. Other houses were dark, but the light on the Owens porch was always kept on. On some occasions, baskets of cakes and pies were left at the door, or freshly made cheese or hand-knitted sweaters, left there by those whose loved ones had been accused of witchcraft, then freed by the governor's decree, for there were those who were convinced that Maria Owens had something to do with his decision. And for this, they would always be grateful. The Owens Library opened in May, the most beautiful month of the year, when it was possible for people in Massachusetts to forget winter, at least until it came again. Maria bought the empty jail after Samuel Diaz made a donation that would cover all costs for its renovation. While the carpenters were at work, they discovered a blue journal hidden behind the bricks. Work stopped for the day. Even the most serious-minded of the men were afraid of that slim blue volume, and not one would touch it. When, at the end of the day, Maria came to see what had been accomplished on the project, the carpenters were sitting in a semicircle, waiting for her, their faces ashen. She thought, perhaps, they had found the remains of a body, for surely there were those who had never left their cells alive. And when she saw that it was her journal that had stopped the men from working and was the reason they stared at her, unsure of what to do next, she was reminded of the first lesson Hannah had taught her. Words had power. Maria kept the journal in the library to remind those who passed through the doors of what had happened in this building. Before it was filled with dozens of volumes, there was a book that had been written here when women were not allowed to speak on their own behalf. In the evenings, there were lessons for those who wished to learn how to read. At first, only women attended, many of whom sneaked out and said they were going to a quilting party, but after a while their husbands came to peer through the door, farmers and fishermen who entered the room with their hats in their hands, shyly picking up a book, then fitting their tall, strong bodies into chairs meant for children. The Maria Owens School for Girls held its first classes soon after, with 10 girls in attendance, aged 6 to 13. Faith Owens taught both Latin and Greek, along with poetry and classics. There were still many in town who thought it was a danger and a disservice to society to educate female students. All the same, several local residents allowed their daughters to register for classes, despite the rumors about the Owens women. Faith was not yet 17, but quite well respected by the girls and their families, who ignored the rumors that vowed both Owens women became crows who flew above the fields after dark, and that they would put a curse on you if you wronged them, and that they swam naked in Leech Lake. It was true that Maria went to the lake on summer mornings. She could only float, but that was enough, for she'd been able to dive the one time she needed to do so. If she wanted to swim there among the water weeds and the lilies, with no clothes on and her hair tied up with blue ribbon, who was to say such a thing wasn't a pleasure and a delight? No one knew whether or not Maria was married, but there was a man who spent winters with her and went to sea each summer. Some people swore he'd come back from the dead and that love had returned him to life. His sailors said little about him when they frequented the taverns, other than to note that he paid them well and was a brilliant navigator. They laughed about his personal habits. He liked to tell stories. He always drank a special tea to give him courage. And wherever they might be, he searched out a certain variety of tree, bringing home so many that the road that led to the Owens house was now called Magnolia Street. It was rumored that if you stood there in May, on the day when the trees bloomed, you were bound to fall in love. But no one believed tall tales such as that, except for those it had happened to, and those couples often married there, rather than in church, and were said to be exceptionally happy. Faith Owens was regularly seen in town with a book in hand, reading as she walked. She wore a wide-brimmed black hat and men's trousers, and she carried a satchel of books to ensure that if she should finish one volume, she would be handily prepared with the next. There was rarely a time when she didn't have her nose in a book, and people would come upon her in the woods, sitting on a rock and reading, or on a ledge by the lake, tossing breadcrumbs into the murky water as she turned the pages. She'd collected dozens of volumes for the new library, meeting with wealthy families throughout Essex County, as well as in Boston and Cambridge, convincing well-to-do patrons that the entire population, men, women, and children alike, must be literate in order for the colony to grow. Several men fell in love with her, but she turned them all down. If they called her beautiful, that was a mark against them, for what a person was could not be seen with the naked eye. She had learned from her mother's mistakes. If she ever fell in love, she wanted someone she could talk to. Although women were not allowed to be students at Harvard College, the esteemed citizen Thomas Brattle, who had written a letter that was critical of the witch trials and was both the treasurer of the college and a member of the Royal Society, had made arrangements for Faith to study in Cambridge. She was closer to Brattle than most people might have supposed, despite their age difference. They appreciated each other's minds, and she was grateful to him for believing in her abilities as a teacher. Faith sat in the back row of the classics seminar at Harvard, allowed only to listen and never to speak. She dressed in boys' clothing in her everyday life, which she found so much more practical than skirts and capes. At Harvard, she could be seen in a black jacket along with trousers and a white shirt and a black tie, the same uniform as the men, so that she might not call attention to herself and her gender, although she hardly went unnoticed due to the red boots she wore every day. "Gentlemen," the professor had told his students on the first day of class when Faith Owens was present, "keep your eyes on me, if you please." Faith had been wrong about many things. She still had the red mark that had arisen in the center of her left palm when Martha Chase drowned. The color had faded, but the blotch was enough to remind her of the bad choices she had made in the past. Every Midsummer's Eve, a sparrow came into the parlor of the house on Magnolia Street. If it completed a circle around the room three times, bad luck was sure to come. Because of this, Faith never forgot the bird whose life she had taken for her own benefit when she made the revenge pie for John Hathorne. Hathorne was a successful trader, but people in town avoided him. There was nothing she wanted from him now, because he had nothing to give her. She always chased the sparrow to the window, then gently urged it out with a broom. Faith still had a penance to pay, and much to set right. For this reason, she went from one farm to another on Saturdays to teach any girl whose parents wouldn't allow her to take time from the workday and attend school. She walked so many miles and came home so late at night that Maria worried she would exhaust herself. One dusky evening, as Faith was crossing a pasture on her way home in the gray light of early winter, a white horse approached her and followed her home. It was the field that had belonged to the Hopwood brothers, and the ground there was still ashy. Faith understood that she was fortunate indeed to be chosen again after Keeper's death. She called the mare Holly, and people became accustomed to seeing her riding through the fields at night, wearing trousers and carrying a satchel of books, her red hair tucked up under her black hat. John Hathorne made certain to avoid the Owens women, but Maria and Ruth occasionally saw each other on the street, and when they did, they embraced as if they were sisters. Ruth had begun to teach reading classes, and every time she went through her garden gate and kept walking until she reached the library, it occurred to her that she hadn't told her husband where she was going or asked for his permission, and she was grateful for the life she led. There were times when Maria and Faith would glance at one another as they set the table for dinner, or worked together choosing ingredients for a cure, or baked the traditional chocolate tipsy cake for birthday celebrations. They had not forgotten the dark time of left-handed magic. But that time was over, and they had forgiven one another. There are none who can fight as fiercely as a mother and a daughter, and none who can forgive more completely. One evening, when Maria was turning on the porch light so that her clients would know they could come calling, Faith followed her outside and handed her the Book of the Raven. She was ashamed of her behavior and of the red mark she carried in the palm of her hand. "I used it badly. It shouldn't be mine." Maria considered burning the book, for it was bound to cause trouble. There was no one to claim it, and by rights it should have been burned at the time of its owner's death. She might have made a bonfire in the rear of the garden and rid the world of it, but the book was so beautiful and the writer so knowledgeable, she couldn't bring herself to destroy it. There were reasons dark books were written by women, those who were not allowed to publish, those who couldn't own property, those who had been sold for sex, those who had grown old and were no longer desirable, women in chains, women who dreamed, women who had turned left when it seemed the only choice. If used carefully, by the right person, the magic in this text could be a great gift. Hidden on the last page, there was a spell to bring about the end of any curse, but the price for doing so was high, and the woman who did so must be fearless. Instead of burning the book, Maria went through the fields into town late at night, in the dark, as she had long ago, when she was mistaken for a crow. She carried the keys that unlocked the library door. She hid the Book of the Raven behind the loose bricks where long ago she had hidden her own journal. She left that book of magic in the place where she'd looked out the window to spy the magnolia, thinking that a miracle had taken place. She worked a few drops of her own blood into the mortar. In time, an Owens woman would discover the book and use it as it should be used, with love and courage and faith. Maria always wore the sapphire Samuel Diaz had given her. Sapphire was the stone of wisdom and of prophecy that allowed the wearer to be true to herself. When he was gone, she let herself miss him. He was too tall for the bed, but it was empty without him. Maria often sat beneath the magnolia tree when he was at sea. Even in foul weather, she found comfort there. When he returned, he would bring back stories of seashells that were as big as cabbages, and mysterious birds with blue feet, of white bears that lived on the ice, and islands where every flower was red. He was arrogant and difficult, a man who liked to argue, but he was a man who could do more than talk. He knew how to listen. She had been wrong about love. She had thought it was meant for fools alone, only to discover it was a fool who walked away from love, no matter the cost or the penalty. They waited for the curse, to see if it could find him, but after a while Maria was satisfied that the curse was convinced Samuel Diaz had remained in the lake that had no end. He wasn't the same person he'd been before he died, and a man could not be cursed twice. On dark nights, when she feared for the women in her family who were yet to be born, she found consolation in the knowledge that an Owens woman was made not only to seek remedies, but to fight curses. Fate can bring what you least expect, and it brought them a daughter they called Hannah Raina Diaz Owens, named after Hannah Owens and Samuel's mother. In this way, two women were returned from the ashes, and remembered each day when their names were spoken. The baby was born in January, a winter baby, with black hair and dark gray eyes. She could call birds to her with a single cry and unfurl the bud of a flower so that it bloomed in the palm of her hand. But she couldn't fall asleep unless her father told her a story. It was time, anyway, Samuel announced one morning. He would stop going to sea. Like his father before him, he had come to love being on land and spent most days in the garden, where he grew vegetables and kept bees that were known for honey that was so sweet strong men cried when they tasted it. Samuel was out there every day, even in winter, spreading hay over the garden, starting hardy seedlings in the sun, wearing his black coat, the baby in a basket beside him. He was always talking, even as he worked, for he had 1,000 stories to tell, and the baby listened so intently she forgot to cry. On the last snowy day in March, when spring was greening beneath the ice, Maria left Samuel asleep in their bed. She tucked Hannah into her coat and walked over the grass that was brittle with frost. Crows clustered above them, and ice shone on the birch trees. As she walked in the cold morning, her breath cutting through the bright air, Maria thought she heard Caden's call. She could remember that day in Devotion Field, in the Essex county of her birth. The fields of snow, the bright blue sky, the forest that was so deep, the woman who taught her the nameless art, the quick black eye of the crow. It was then that she saw what was before them, what she had always seen in the mirror, a black heart in the snow. A nest had been tossed from a branch when the wind swept through. Maria knelt to point out the small fledgling to the baby. The blackbird ignored Maria, but he looked at the baby with his glittering eye, unafraid. You cannot choose a familiar. It must choose you. When Hannah held out her hand, the crow came to her and settled beside her, tucked into Maria's coat. Maria felt the beat of his heart inside him slowing to match the baby's heartbeat. They would take him home and wrap him in a blanket, and Hannah would feed him sugar water from the tip of her finger. In no time he would be hopping around the house, perching on the staircase and on the brass rods above the damask curtains. By the time spring had fully bloomed, he would be flying. He would never be far from the girl who had been born on a snowy day, whose father had come home from the sea so that he could tell her every story he knew, whose sister took her in her arms to read to her, whose mother would teach her all she needed to know. This is how you begin in this world. These are the lessons to be learned. Drink chamomile tea to calm the spirit. Feed a cold and starve a fever. Read as many books as you can. Always choose courage. Never watch another woman burn. Know that love is the only answer.
Magic Lessons, the prequel to Practical Magic, was written by Alice Hoffman and read by Sutton Foster. Editing, mix, and post-production by Glenn Corporated. The associate producer was Tiffany Ferrari. Magic Lessons was produced and directed by Erica Weintraub. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Magic Lessons, the prequel to Practical Magic, is available in print from Simon & Schuster. Also from Alice Hoffman for Simon & Schuster Audio, The Rules of Magic, a novel, read by Marin Ireland. And The World That We Knew, a novel, read by Judith Light.